You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, January 29th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building, the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Washington Bureau Chief of the Huffington Post, Ryan Grimm. On the President's State of the Union address and the 43 rebuttals by the Republican Party. Also on the program today, Farm Bill set for vote today in the House, cutting food stamps by $8 billion. And it turns out that Freedom Industries, they forgot to tell West Virginians about one-third of the amount of the chemicals that spilled into the Elk River. 33%. Speaking of 33%, an enormous number of people who in 2008 identified as middle class now perceive themselves as being in a lower class or in poverty. A congressman loses it in the House. We will get to that also, that story on Howie Kurtz, the not-so-reliable source. Yes. Thank you. Also, on the program today, we are anticipating an interview with that guy, Austin Ruse, from, what does CFAM stand for?
Catholic Family, isn't it like the Catholic Family Network or something?
All right. Well, good job, producers, on that.
I apologize. I thought you
give me a second here because I'm turning off the Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute.
Yes. The Catholic Family and Human Rights. Oh, I do have that somewhere. Sorry. The Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute, which weirdly apparently this guy does not think that gay people should be on television. Based on that that recording we found from that radio show, we may need to pull and find out exactly when that was from. So look that up. He will be on the program a little bit later because we got into some type of Twitter thing, and I'm actually really curious as to what's so problematic with having gay people on television. But I'm sure it'll be interesting and fun. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ryan Grimm.
But it's coming home for lunch. people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes. Got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same.
Look the same. Look the same.
There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
Anything. Anything.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
What it was.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Washington Bureau Chief of the Huffington Post, Ryan Grimm. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, look, I want to start off by saying that I don't in any way condone what you did to that New York One reporter in the rotunda of the Capitol building. I thought that was highly inappropriate, but I didn't realize how much of a toughie you were.
That kid had it coming. And besides, it's not what I did to him. It's what I'm going to do to him if he ever does that again. I didn't do anything. What did I? It's a few words.
Oh, boy.
Look, well, he's a boy. I'll break him in half.
We're, of course, folks, just referencing Ryan's older brother, Michael Grimm, who weirdly puts an M, an extra M on his name, I think. He is the congressman.
He does put an extra M.
He's the congressman from Staten Island. That's probably so he doesn't get tagged with your history of drug promotion.
That probably wouldn't fly in Staten Island.
No,
true.
There you go.
I can't explain why Russ Grimm spells it wrong, though.
Was it Russ Grimm? No, it was...
No, Mike. Russ is the plays for the Washington Department of Football.
Oh, I had no idea. Sorry. All right, well, there you have it. So Michael Grimm, we will talk about that later in the program. I'm not going to waste your time with that. But let's talk about the State of the Union address. I assumed you watched it.
I did watch it. How about you?
I did. You know, and I have to admit that partway through it, I was like... Why am I doing this? But because there is, I mean, for a while this was going to be billed as he was going to make a very strong case about income inequality. And then I guess a couple of days before the speech, there was, they started to report that he was not going to get full throated about income inequality, basically because he was afraid of hurting very wealthy people's feelings, which to me is probably the first piece of evidence as to why income inequality is a problem in this country. Because there's an out, the constituency for not mentioning that is rather small, I would imagine, but extremely wealthy.
It's just stunning how thin-skinned the 0.1% is. I mean, they want everything. You know, they want all the wealth, they want all the power, and they don't want anyone to say anything mean about it. It's, you know, you would think that if the world was as Darwinian as they claim that it is, that they'd be a little bit tougher at this point. You know, if they rose all the way to the top here, the very, very, very top, they somehow did it without being able to take a single bit of criticism.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's not just the thin-skinnedness, I should say, of guys like Tom Perkins and Ken Langone and whoever it is. It's also the fact that, like, if we're to believe the earlier reporting and sort of based on his speech in December, if we're to believe that they were aiming for a speech about income inequality and then made such a sort of wholesale reemphasis of their speech, the administration did, that is even more astonishing in some ways.
It's truly astonishing. And if you couple that with what he told Remnick in that long, long New Yorker profile, you know, he said that, you know, he wants as his legacy, for his administration to be seen as the time and kind of an inflection point where, the lines on the chart started moving in the right direction, and that he, you know, along with the Pope, was going to make, the existence of this terrible income inequality, something that the public is forced to grapple with, and he's going to use his gifts as a storyteller, to allow people to see it. That was something that he can do because he doesn't, nobody can filibuster that or block it in the House. He's just going to use his bully pulpit. This is what he himself said he was going to do. He has how many states of the union left after this one? Two? I mean, no, one. He's got 2016.
Right.
He has these few opportunities to tell this story, which he began to tell eloquently in December, and then he just pulled up short.
Yeah, I want to circle back to this because I want to get to sort of like there was, to watch the coverage last night. I mean, I could barely take my eyes off of Frank Luntz just knowing how depressed he is on Fox. But that said, I want to circle back to that part about it. Let's get into some of the specifics. But I think what you just said is the real sort of fundamental point to be made about this State of the Union, but let's go through a couple of the specifics and then we'll circle back on that, because the other theme that they were going to push here was that he's going to take control now to the extent that he can. I'm going to bypass Congress. I'm not going to show any, he was very careful not to poke anybody in the eye last night. But he's basically saying, if you're not going to do anything, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. So he's going to do this minimum wage thing with federal contractors. He didn't even go that far with that by saying that it's the existing contracts, right?
No, it's not. Yeah. And maybe he couldn't. I don't know the law on that. But, right, he didn't do that. It's contracts going forward. And he didn't, there's a lot of pressure on him to do an ENDA, an Employee Non-Discrimination Act for LGBT discrimination in hiring among federal workers. And he didn't mention that and isn't going there yet.
Did you hear anything from the administration as why that's the case? Or is that just something that, I don't know, is it
what they've always said is that they don't want to take pressure off of Congress on this, that they feel like if they go out and do it, then Congress has less incentive to do it. But why do the minimum wage?
I don't know.
Argument apply there? It's not an argument that's satisfying the LGBT folks.
Right. All right. Well, let's move on to the Myra that he proposed, which I felt like I vomited in my mouth a little bit when he talked about that. That's basically a savings bond that is more convenient to purchase if you're not offered a 401k at your work. I guess that's nice, but that doesn't really do anything for the problem of that we see in terms of 401ks, 51% being basically useless that people have in terms of providing their retirement. It just seemed like filler to me. Am I being too cynical about that?
I mean, I think you can look at it both ways. I think it'll probably be something that'll be useful on the margins to some people. The idea, as it's been described to me, is that there are a bunch of predatory products out there for low-income people who do want to save, and that this is a public option, so to speak. To the extent that that's true, then great. I think it's nice that people have some ability to save a little bit of money without getting ripped off by predatory folks. But like you said, that still leaves you with you know, the dramatic retirement crisis that we're facing. So, you know, it's kind of a window into how little the president either can do or is willing to do, you know, with his pen and his phone, as he's been saying. Like, if, you know, if he took the best minds of his administration and had them, you know, sit in rooms with whiteboards and markers and figure out, you know, what can I do as you know, with the awesome power of the presidency over the next few years, and that this is what he came up with, then, you know, we're in trouble.
Yeah, they didn't spend too much time, I guess, on the branding of that either. I think it's
he didn't even unroll it right. You know, he at first he called it a My IRA, and did not realize that he was trying to be a little cleverer than that. My IRA or
Myra,
whatever
I think it's called.
Myra.
And
are they calling it a Myra? Then why?
Should the last A be
lowercase if it's a Myra?
Yeah,
they have it. They have it capital M, lowercase y, capital R, capital A. That's My IRA.
My IRA.
I'm not allowing them to rebrand it the next day.
I just think it's also, you know, this was also an opportunity to throw in, like, we should do X, Y, or Z on Social Security, which would have made a lot of sense. Like, you know, this is what I can do for executive action. I can make it very convenient for people to buy savings bonds, essentially, and government-backed savings bonds, and we should be doing something on Social Security. I was talking to some guys that I was at a healthcare conference with some Social Security and Medicare activists who had apparently sat down with Gene Sperling last week in the White House, and they came out of that conversation just convinced that if the president had an opportunity to cut Social Security again, he would take it in a heartbeat. And so that's why I think he couldn't.
Yes, he's made that clear from, I think, before day one, practically.
Yes.
That he thinks that Democrats laying down for Social Security like this is one of those tired dogmas and things of the past that, you know, people need to move beyond. And, you know, he put cuts to Social Security in his budget.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
funny that you say it that way, because I've not heard anybody articulate that that's the way the president sees it. But it reminds me of a conversation I had with Jonathan Alter 2 years ago, who said that, you know, why is this sort of old thinking about Social Security? That liberals have this chastity belt when it comes to Social Security. And I was just, I mean, this was in the green room. I was a little bit, wow, this is the guy who's now sort of, you know, I think at that time he was writing his book on President Obama. But
there's a lot of people kind of in the neoliberal world that see it that way. This is an old statist, dogmatic approach, and, you know, some people say this, some people say that, and us smarter people will, you know, find something in the middle, and I think that's where they get this idea. They've run up against the brick wall of the American people on it, but that's where they are.
He also talked about urging CEOs of major companies to not discriminate against the long-term unemployed. That's nice. Let's move on to the next one.
You know, all discrimination has a cultural component to it. And so to the extent that the president can move the culture around the stigma of hiring the long-term jobless, I think we ought to give him credit for that.
Well, I give him credit for that.
If you can somehow make people think twice about it, then you've at least gone somewhere. I mean, more jobs would be better. Obviously,
but you know, he didn't even say full employment. I mean, you know, that's the weird thing about this is that he touched on these topics as if to say, like, we did address unemployment, we did, you know, and he just didn't seem to have let's skip ahead to the only thing that I think, frankly, the most relevant thing that is going to have any type of long term implications. And I, you know, and granted, all of the issues of Republican obstructionism, there's really very little that he could do unilaterally, short of the rhetoric he was telling David Remnick that he was interested in. But the most important thing, I think, as he said, was that I'm going to veto any new Iran sanctions bill that comes ahead.
Mm-hmm.
The weird thing is, that's the least talked about aspect of the speech, as far as I can tell. And in some respects, it was the most relevant relative to what he can do.
So, yeah, and actually, I think we're going to make that our top story later this afternoon.
Bingo. You just hired me as your chief executive
there
editor.
There you go. That issue has interestingly not really kind of broken through into the the national conversation. It's out there, and people who are closely following politics are very well aware of it and following it closely, but it's not really leading cable or getting chatted about on cable or the nightly news or Morning Joe. There's something about it that hasn't really penetrated. But that was, I think you're right, that was the most, significant and consequential moment. And what you're seeing already is that it's having an effect because, a statement from the president that he would veto something is different than him pounding the lectern during the State of the Union, because that means that now any Democrat who's still pushing forward on this it ratchets up the conflict that they're taking on as a part of that. So as a result, today you're already seeing people start to shed and this issue shed some support, like Joe Manchin last night on MSNBC was like, well, he's a co-sponsor of this sanctions bill and he's backed off of it. So, and we're seeing a few more today that we'll publish later. I think you're right. That was a big deal.
And why do you think it's getting so little attention? I mean, it's almost as if like the Republicans can't go full throated on this because of what's happening internally with their politics, and that the Democrats who were supporting this were obviously their support to increase the sanctions, which is, I think can be at the very least largely attributable. I mean, with guys like Schumer anyways, as a sort of a kowtow to Israel's interests in some respects, or I should say the right wing in Israel. But why do you think it's getting so little attention? I mean, is it just that nobody wants to be out there saying, we got to get to war, guys, again?
I mean, I don't know. I think there's a variety of reasons. When we first started covering this several weeks ago and making the case that you're making, we found ourselves on the receiving end of angry letters denouncing us as anti-Semitic from the ADL and several other Jewish organizations.
Abe Foxman just texted me.
And I'm sure that he'll text me soon. It's a complicated issue, and that doesn't really play well on nightly news and cable. So that that has something to it. On the other hand, it's kind of a simple issue. On the third hand, if there are that many, I think there's some war fatigue that's probably playing into this. But this would be the second kind of victory for peace in a row in Congress after, Syria. Syria is a war-torn hellhole, but the U.S. didn't bomb it because Congress pushed back, and now you have the faction in Congress that wants negotiations rather than war winning out. So I think that in itself is an interesting trend, and reflects the war weariness of the public.
Yeah, I'm both sort of surprised by the lack of coverage of it, and it didn't even seem like the Republicans were pushing back on that at all. I didn't hear anybody talk about it last night afterwards, and it was I just found that sort of just stunning in a way. I mean, it's almost as if like mm-hmm. the Republicans can't seem to let go of Obamacare as a as a central tenet for their being at this point. And there was,
and it's better. I mean, focusing on Obamacare is way better for them. They know that their brand, when it comes to saber rattling and talking about aggression in the Middle East and near Middle East, is just in the toilet. Nobody wants to hear any war cries from the Republican Party for another 10 years or so.
Yeah, and I got to say, the president really does deserve credit on this. It is the one thing that I feel sort of like that was, he genuinely deserves credit on that. But now let's move, because I had read that Remnick piece in The New Yorker, and I had the exact same feelings about I don't understand what's going on here. Now, Chris Matthews last night on MSNBC was saying that this was the best speech he could possibly give. And then Mark Halperin came on. The argument that Matthews was making is that he needs to get back up to 50% with people in the middle, to make sure that the Democrats win the 2014 Senate elections, so that he can have some chance of getting something done in the future. This does not make any sense to me. I mean, is it the people in the middle who go out and vote on a down year election? Like, I don't understand what the agenda is here. And I'm not even talking about from a policy standpoint. I don't understand what the agenda here is from a legacy or a political standpoint. Help me understand this.
Well, I can't really be. I mean, I think you're right. So you've got, so you're talking about this a supposed midterm election voter who wants to hear, who's going to either, decide between a Democratic Senate candidate or a Republican Senate candidate based on a kind of a moderate speech from the president in January. I don't know the universe of voters who fit into that. I don't think that there's very many of them. I think you'd probably be more able to find, disaffected voters who were energized by a tough speech, or voters who were kind of motivated by friends of theirs who were energized by a more aggressive speech. But I don't know. That's not my business. I've never gotten anybody elected anything. That's not true. I got some people elected to my co-op board. It's very GOTV driven campaign. So that's not really relevant here.
I mean, but that seems to me like, let me ask you this then. I mean, if there is and I don't know either. I mean, maybe it's those people in the middle, the people who, thought that, they just want a competent guy. And so based upon their sense that President Obama is a take charge type of guy, they're going to go out and vote for a Democratic, Senate candidate. But, let's assume that that's not the typical voter in a midterm election. Would this speech have done anything to put those Republican Senate candidates in any type of box? In other words, like, even if it was just a minimum wage, rather than like, let's just give America a raise. Would this speech have sort of said, these are the people who are stopping the minimum wage? I mean, that's what really sort of I found.
Yeah, I mean, if you
go ahead.
And bringing it back to what we were talking about earlier, if you tied it to, the theme of inequality powerfully, like he was hinting that he was going to do, and then you laid out some of the structural obstacles to solving that problem, and you laid out that one of them was the Republican Party's refusal ideologically to give people a raise, and you tied it to corporate executives who are making huge salaries while the taxpayers are paying for food stamps and Medicaid for their employees, and you play that kind of populist resentment card, which seems to be a big reason why I think the minimum wage is getting a push again. That does put them in the box that you're talking about. And maybe it has some midterm or presidential political benefit for you, but it might even get them to vote for a minimum wage increase.
Right. And did the president even? I mean, I'm sure he mentioned unemployment benefits, but he didn't really. Did he really spend any? I mean, it did not seem like there was any pressure being put on there. It really just seemed like he was just saying, like, you know, Congress is broken. I don't know. To me, this was at odds with what he had told Remnick in some respects. To me, it just seems to me that the whole idea here is like, how can I get out of this whole situation unscathed? I mean, honestly, like that. My sense of what he's trying to achieve for his legacy at this point is just, I want people to look back at me as a guy who didn't pick any fights. I followed the path. I got some signature legislation passed, and I wasn't unnecessarily, aggressive in some ways.
Right. Yeah. I think he tried last time, vote on this, vote on that. These people deserve a vote. This guy deserves a vote. Give me a vote. And he actually did get some votes. He got a vote on his on some gun legislation that didn't overcome a filibuster and a bunch of other stuff he just never got votes on. But his entire speech was, a bunch of fist pounding, give me a vote. So instead he went all the way to the other side and was like, you know what? Vote or don't vote. Either way, fine. I'm good.
And I gotta
say,
I'm
gonna figure out some things I can do.
I gotta say that voter don't that you know give me a vote. I'm not convinced that didn't at the very least maybe impact the decision of a couple of holdouts in the Senate as to whether or not we should get rid of the filibuster when it comes to nominees. Right? I mean that mm-hmm. to the extent that there's that it had any impact, it was obviously positive in that respect. That's a big deal. He's now has these branches, and we can overstate the relevance of a speech, but this, let's put it this way, there is no other speech that he's going to give prior to the 2014 election that's going to have this audience, assuming it's not in response to some type of catastrophe, right? I mean, am I wrong about that?
Right. No, I think that's right. I mean, I think part of it, though, is we just have a system that, by design or whatever, just doesn't work. It would be neat if you could, run on a particular agenda, get elected, and then implement that agenda and see if people liked the results of it, then hold another election to determine whether people liked it or not. We don't do that. We run on an agenda, people pick that agenda, and then it doesn't get implemented. And then the incumbent hopes that the economy is, coincidentally improving while they're in office so that they can get reelected. If it is, they usually get reelected. If it's not, they don't. And then you divine some ideological sympathies, from that and, apply them to the American people. It's just a mess. I mean, but like I was saying, it's still not designed to work.
Do you have a sense as to how strongly the administration feels that how crucial they feel it is to retain the Senate?
Oh, I think they think it's extremely crucial, if not just to like spend the next 2 years batting away, Obamacare harassment.
He's going to have a Supreme
judges.
Court pick or two.
Yeah, Supreme Court and all the rest of the judiciary. I think they would be awfully disappointed if they finally got around to blowing up the filibuster on judicial and executive nominations, and then all of a sudden you don't have the Senate anymore. So that I think that would be a very big deal.
Do you have a sense of how people in the Senate, folks who are running for re-election, what their perspective was? I mean, did they feel that they were helped, do you think? I mean, I'm just trying to, because I mean,
I don't know. Actually, I didn't talk to any of those folks, so I can't really.
You're too busy
that.
Beating up on New York One reporters.
I was actually asking everybody who they were wearing last night, so that's what I was focused on.
Ryan Grimm.
You think I'm kidding?
What? Oh, right. Well, wait, who was wearing what?
Sherrod Brown was wearing Hugo Boss. Apparently union made in Ohio.
Really? I didn't know.
Yeah.
That's fancy stuff. That's very good to know. What was Franken wearing last night?
I didn't get Franken. Ted Cruz was wearing his famous lizard boots, though.
All right. Hey, let's take one more minute here. What did you make of the idea that Ted Cruz was actually competing? There was a series, I guess is the best way to say it, of GOP responses. I mean, first we had Kathy McMorris Rodgers, which I thought she did a good job of not destroying her career, which seems to be the bar, essentially, if you're giving the official GOP response. And then Mike Lee gave his Tea Party response right after Kathy McMorris' Rogers response, but was competing against, I guess, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. Rand Paul did it on YouTube, but Ted Cruz and Rand Paul were actually on television while Mike Lee was giving his speech. What's going on? Are we just moving into, like, is this like some type of like McLaren that said that, you know, everybody gets their 15 minutes or whatever? McLuhan gets their 50. I mean, like, everybody's going to, pretty soon, the entire Republican Party will give a response.
Yes. I mean, you know, with no front runner, you know, it's kind of anarchic. And Ted Cruz is just, it's not obvious that he's even human, the way that he can deliver speeches. And like, if you can ask him about, say, Chris Christie, and he will give you a, you know, three paragraph response that is verbatim identical to one he gave like 2 weeks earlier, like down. You know, it's just absolutely remarkable. I've never seen anything like it. Like, and last night when he was talking to reporters after the speech in a scrum, in no like video cameras, just, you know, microphones, he doesn't talk like any other politician. He delivered a speech. Towards the end of it, he used the phrase, and I'll just close with this, which is just not language you ever hear in a scrum with, like, you know, 15, 20 reporters who are, like, you know, it's shouting questions and doing it back and forth. He just doesn't do that. He's quite a remarkable politician.
And was there any talk about, I mean, isn't Mike Lee his, you know, his buddy? I mean, was he stepping on Mike Lee? I mean, what was going on there?
I mean, you know, if you've chosen Ted Cruz as your ally, I don't think loyalty is the thing you expect.
There you go. All right. Well, Ryan Grimm, I appreciate you coming on and talking about the State of the Union. I guess we'll find out in November. I don't know. That's a long way off.
Better get your judges through now.
All right. Well, good luck with your upcoming change in parental status.
Yeah, man.
Good luck with that.
Nothing to it, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it's easy, buddy.
Yeah.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Thanks so much.
See ya.
Bye-bye. All right. Now, I think, do we know that we're hearing from this guy? We haven't heard him respond. Well, he's supposed to call into the program, that Austin Ruse.
Yeah, the phone's up.
Well, yeah, the phones are up. We will endeavor to. We're anticipating him calling now, right?
Yes.
Well, we'll see.
We are anticipating his call now.
All right. Well, we will take a quick break, and Oh, all right. It's 12:41. All right. So we'll take a quick break. Maybe we'll include part of this in the free show. Maybe we won't. But, folks, you can get the fun half and support the free show on a daily basis by going to majority.fm and becoming a member today. You can also support this show by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% discount. Give us a review on iTunes. Pick up the app. Hopefully in the better half of the program today, the funner half, I guess we brand it now, we'll be talking to Austin Ruse, who was on a radio program saying that, what was the radio program? He was on a conservative show, right?
I just saw it through tweets. People started
tweeting.
No,
he just started tweeting.
No,
the segment we did on him originally.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. He was on a conservative radio show. This was from July 2nd we did this segment, so I don't know.
Yes,
exactly,
I'm asking what the name of the conservative radio show was. Anyways, he was on that show, and he said that he was talking about a horrible time he had with...
he was filling in for Sandy Rios.
Oh, so he was...
Show.
Oh,
was
I see.
Yeah.
So he was actually just hosting the show. And he was talking about how upsetting it was for him to get into a situation where he saw some lesbians on a cooking show. So
maybe that's what's happened today.
Maybe we're having problems with the radio, with the phone system. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll deal with that. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be back in just a moment.